Accession number 19909, Reel 2.
Warwick Taylor, Reel 2.
The warden came round next morning and he said, "Come on, up, out of bed, no scrounges here." I said, I feel terrible. "Go sick," he said then. So I felt too ill to even get dressed. I staggered across to the sick bay in my pyjamas in the pouring rain. I got into the sick bay. There were others in there. And a receptionist said, "Take a seat." And I just collapsed on the floor. Next thing I knew, I was in bed in the sick bay. And they said, "Oh, we don't know what's wrong with you at all." It was, you know, I felt absolutely dreadful. I felt sick, and I was coughing up blood. They kept me in that sick bay for 5 days, and they said, "We're sending you to hospital. A taxi is coming for you. Taxi, mind you, not an ambulance." Taxi arrived. I was still in pyjamas. I couldn't get dressed. Oh, at any rate, my clothing was still left in the billet, in my locker. So off we set to the taxi arrived and we went towards the hospital. The taxi driver said, "We've got to make a call on the way. We've got to pick up a pregnant lady in one of the Welsh villages who I've also got to take to hospital." So we called in at I can't remember where it was. It was either Risker or Cross Keys or somewhere like that. We picked up this lady. And there were the two of us sitting in the back of the taxi. She was going in and out of labour, and I was going in and out of consciousness. We arrived at the hospital in Newport. It was called the Newport Infirmary. After that, I don't know, I passed out again. Next thing I knew, next day, I was coming round. My temperature, by the way, was 106.7. Now, that is right on the edge. They actually, the authorities sent for my parents and who came down, and they said, "I'm afraid that your son will not see the night through." How wrong they were, thank goodness. Fortunately, I remember a Professor McMichael came to see me, and a new drug had just come out called penicillin. And he knew immediately what was wrong. He said, "Oh, this man's suffering from double pneumonia." Penicillin, 1 million units every 8 hours. And they just jabbed this into me. And of course it brought the temperature down just like that. But you're not out of the woods yet, because with pneumonia you go through a crisis several days later. When I came round, I was in a ward with 5 other men. They were all soldiers, critically wounded, and had been brought back from Dunkirk. And when I looked around, I thought...
From Dunkirk?
From Dunkirk they'd come, yes. And I thought, good heavens, this could have been the alternative. You know, if I'd been drafted into the army, that could have been me. I could have been any one of those. At any rate, I was in hospital for 6 weeks, and pneumonia cleared itself up, and one snag with the penicillin, of course it makes your hair fall out, and I thought, what, my girlfriend back in Pinner, she won't want to know me when she sees me now, you know. But they said, "Well, don't worry about that. It's only temporary. It'll grow again." And I was discharged from the hospital and sent on sick leave. I think it was about 2 months of sick leave. Then I was called up for another medical examination. A1 fit, back. So I had to go back again into the coma. Of course, I had to be retrained again now. Go through all that training ceremony. Again, the 4 weeks training.
At the same place?
At the same place. Of course, now we were getting, the war was getting close to a finish. We were getting near to May of 1945. And I went back, I was retrained, and they kept me there actually at that colliery at Oakdale. They didn't post me on to another one. And the war finished, of course, and I was one of the first home. We weren't supposed to shoot off, but I shot home immediately since the war was over. I wanted the celebrations at home, not down there in Wales. I ought to mention really about, I have to be very careful how I say this, about the Welsh people are fine people, great. But there was a resentment for the fact that we were down there. Welsh communities are very, very close-knit. And they did feel that there was a resentment that the fact that we'd come there to take away the jobs from the regular miners, their own kith and kin who were in the armed forces, and we'd come there permanently to take away the jobs from them. Well, they were right in a way to feel like that, of course.
How did they show the resentment?
Oh, this was said to me. There was a woman in the street pushing a baby in a pram, and she shouted out at me and said, "We don't want you here, clear off. Go back home, you know, if only we could have done." And I think that was the general feeling. And of course, another thing was, being in civilian dress and of military age, you were often either challenged by the public. They thought you were conscientious objectors, which we weren't as baby boys, of course. This is very wrong. Or that we were draft dodgers, or the police might stop you thinking you were an enemy agent. So it wasn't a happy situation, really, being a Bevin boy at all.
When she shouted out to you, did you respond? Or
yes, I think I probably did respond and said, "Well, it's not my fault, you know, we didn't ask to be here." And of course, another thing is down in, I remember a case actually underground where, more on the humorous side, that all Bevin boys, don't forget, we all worked underground either on conveyor belts or on the movement of the tubs. In Wales, they're called drams. That's these trucks where the coal is put into. It's fed off the conveyor belts into these drams or tubs. And then they have to be moved and empty ones put in their place. And ponies are sometimes used. I don't remember ponies at Oakdale, but this was another colliery nearby. Apparently, a lot of Bevin boys worked with ponies. And in this particular case, the particular Bevin boy couldn't get this pony to move. You know, you've got to sort of give them the commands or prod them to start moving. Because a pit pony could carry up to two of these tubs, fully laden. And the reason was he couldn't get it to move is that the pony didn't understand English. It only understood Welsh. So that was it. And I think we found this in Wales, that the Welsh people spoke a lot amongst themselves in their own language, and you didn't really know what they were saying about you at all. I think it took some time for them to actually accept us. Now, this doesn't necessarily apply in other parts of the country, because I've heard different stories from those in the Durham area, for instance, and Yorkshire, where we were sort of quite readily accepted. But it was always, you were always open to have some sort of prank played on you. Fortunately, it didn't happen to me. But a lot of pranks were actually played on Bevin boys, you know. But I'll tell you something that this really taught me. I mean, my time as a Bevin boy was only just over 2 years. But it taught me something about the miner. Very important. What a marvellous job, magnificent, essential job that he does. And people don't realise, because it's a highly dangerous job. And it's filthy dirty, you know. It's not the pleasantest of jobs at all. Oh, pay, I never mentioned about pay that Bevin boys got. We got £3.10 a week. Now, out of that, of course, they deducted your hostel accommodation. Or, if you're in billets, your billet accommodation. It always came to £1.25 a week. It was always deducted for your accommodation. When you worked underground, you always took with you food. Your hostel provided always breakfast and a main meal, but you needed another meal when you worked. You took this in the form of sandwiches. Butter was very scarce in wartime, of course. It was mainly margarine. And another thing in wartime, because you never got white bread. White bread didn't exist. It was a sort of dirty brown. That's why the nation, really, in wartime, was very much healthier in those days than it is today. And it's because of the type of food that we have. It was a very, very bland diet. And it was essential, of course, every baby boy to take sandwiches, an apple or something like that, with him when he worked underground. This was provided, of course, by the hostel. And you contain this food in a snap tin, or sometimes it's called a bait tin. It's a strong tin, sealed. And the object, of course, of it being sealed is because underground there are rats and mice. Now, they're down there. They get down there in the hay and straw that goes over the ponies. And, of course, a pony will soon know if you've got some food there. It's important to keep it away from him. And another essential thing to take with you, of course, was water. Because Oakdale, I found, was... A coal mine can be very hot in the deep mines or cold in the shallow mines. And it can be very, very drafty underground. Because there's a constant, very, very strong airflow. Naturally, because a mine has got to be well ventilated. And this is done, of course, by means of the downcast shaft and the upcast. And the air is driven by enormous fans to generate it. Because the air underground can be diverted to the area where you want it. It's done by means of brattice doors. You don't want air, obviously, going into areas that are not being used. So, let's say the day eventually came for them. The war finished, and I thought, right, I'm going to start means of appealing. So eventually I kept on and on. I thought, well, the war's over now, but I still hadn't completed my national service, because as a Bevin boy you wouldn't get out, or you wouldn't be demobilised until 1948. And they adopted a similar scheme to that of the forces in by giving you a demobilisation number. I appealed, and I thought, you know, and every time you appeal, they start sending you for another medical examination. I know it seemed to be an automatic process. So I went for another medical, and then I had to see the Ministry of Labour official. He said, what's the problem? I said, well, I want to go in the Royal Air Force. I was very, very keen to do this. So he said, right, I think we can do something. The war's finished. All of a sudden, I received an envelope through the post giving me call-up papers for the army. Report to Canterbury. I said, what's this? So I sent them back. No, I said, this isn't me. You've got the wrong person. I said, it's the Air Force. So all of a sudden, I then received papers for the Royal Air Force. And I thought, at last. So I had a report to RAF Padgate. And this was a continuation of national service. So really I was released from the coal mining industry by the Ministry of Labour or the Ministry of Fuel and Power, because you also came under that, to continue and complete my national service in the Royal Air Force.
And so how long had you been in the mines?
I'd been in the mines over 2 years.
This is near to 45, 46.
Yeah, that's right. So it was 1946.
You have said really very much of the actual work underground that you were doing.
The work underground, in my particular case, I was employed on the conveyor belts. Now, a lot of coal came off the conveyor belts, it was spillage. They used to tip over it onto the sides. And my job was to shovel it and keep the areas clean, the walkways clean, and put the coal back onto the conveyor belts. So really it was a labour-intensive shoveling job that I was employed on. Sometimes I would be employed on the actual tubs, the linking up of the tubs. Now, in the corrie there, we use a sort of a continuous moving cable system, and you had to lash these tubs onto this, chain them onto the moving conveyor belt to keep the tubs moving. But I wasn't very keen on that job because it was very dangerous, and you could very easily injure your hand. With these moving cables and that, and if you didn't put your chain on correctly, you could catch your thumb in it and lose your thumb quite easily. So I preferred my job actually shoveling the coal back onto conveyor belts. Not many Bevin boys actually progressed onto the coal face. Very, very few, because really they were the more experienced miners that were employed on the coalface work. And I think they got extra pay anyway for that particular job. And it was dangerous too, again, because of the exploding the colliery. They don't use explosives today, but they did then, of course.
Would the regular miners have resented it had Evan By gone on to the coalface?
I don't think so, no. Some did, but not very many. But I think they would have to pull their weight. Because don't forget, these miners are on bonus. And if you had a Bevin boy that really wasn't sort of, didn't have his heart into it, well, most of us didn't really. We didn't want to be there anyway. But, okay, you were there to do a job, well, you've got to just lamp it and get on with it. And I think they felt if they pulled their weight, which we did do, and there was a lot of resentment in the beginning, and I think they had problems with us, and there was a lot of absenteeism as well. This was a big problem by Bevin boys absconding and going back home, because if you did do that, if you absconded and went back home, in a week or so, of course, the authorities would notify the local police. You find the local policeman would come to your house and say, right, he wouldn't arrest you, he'd just say, I've got notification here that you've absconded from the coal mines. You are to report to the Ministry of Labour and National Service, Labour Exchange in your area, now. And of course you'd be sent back again. We didn't get very much leave as a boat. You didn't get the same concessions or the privileges as you would have had in the services. And of course, which I noticed most, this stood out very much when I went into the Royal Air Force. You only got, as a Bevin boy, just 1 week's holiday a year.
Could you take that when you wanted to?
No, you couldn't. No, it was a fixed. It was a fixed week. They closed the colliery for the week. You also got another day off, Christmas Day, but you didn't get Boxing Day, which was a bit ridiculous, really, because if you got home for Christmas, you say you left Christmas Eve, you probably couldn't get transportation back there anyway. And of course, if you were absent, because they started work again on the Boxing Day, if you were absent, you were fined £2 for every day of absenteeism. And of course, if this absenteeism continued, you'd then probably be hauled up before the local magistrate. And you could be threatened with imprisonment. In fact, one or two of our baby boys did actually go to prison. But they wouldn't give you a fixed term of imprisonment. They say you can stay in prison until you agree to go back to the coal mines. So in other words, the release is up to you. You know, in other words, you can sit there for 3 months until you change your mind.
Would you get bank holidays off?
No. No, but you've got to realise this is wartime. And production was important. In 1943, there was only 3 weeks' coal supply left in the United Kingdom. This is very serious. And don't forget, coal, of course, was used for everything, not only just in your private homes. Of course, it was used in industry and for shipping and for the railways, everything. Everybody was burning coal. Very much unlike today, of course.
And you were doing shifts?
We were doing shifts, that's right, yes. You had a sort of an early shift, a middle shift, which is really more or less like a late shift. Night shifts were basically for regular miners. Their job would be to sort of remove heaps of coal that were mined in the day and clearing the area so that you had a fresh start in the morning. Fortunately, I didn't do a night shift. It was only a sort of an early and mid-late.
And which collieries were you working in?
I worked in Oakdale Colliery down in South Wales.
Just the one?
Just the one, where I remained there the entire time. But of course, there were many collieries in South Wales, and lots of the chaps that were trained there were sent to one of many hundreds of collieries within the South Wales area.
What was the nature of the coal that you were mining there?
The type of coal was a Welsh coal, Welsh nuts. It was a very, very good coal, quite a shiny type of good burning coal. It could be used for all sorts of purposes, industrial use or household use. The miners of South Wales suffered with a lot of chest diseases. Basically, I think this type of coal produced a lot of dust, and miners got silicosis, pneumoconiosis, and anthracosis. It didn't take. Fortunately, Bevin boys didn't suffer any chest diseases. The reason being, we weren't in the industry long enough for it to happen. But regular miners did actually suffer a lot from... all Bevin boys, by the way, worked underground. None of us worked on the surface. And the reason for that is, of course, that the older miners were employed on the surface, or those that were in rather poor health would be employed on surface work. Now, most of the surface work, of course, was carried out in screening sheds. And this is where the coal, when it came up in the tubs, up in the lifts, up in the shafts, the cages, would go to the screening sheds where it would be graded, sorted and washed. And then it would be conveyed into railway trucks. And don't forget, during wartime, it was all private ownership. All the collieries were owned by private companies. They weren't nationalised until 1947. And it was basically the same with the railways, of course, who had all this private ownership. And the coal would be loaded into the trucks. That's why it was essential, as I said, in the early time, to get these clear the snow from the tracks. Because the trucks would then go to various distribution centres or generating stations and this sort of thing to where the coal could be used.
Who owned the coal mine that you worked in?
It was owned by the Oakdale Steam Navigation Company. Where I was, of course, in Oakdale, there were a lot of collieries round and about. Oakdale was a small little, well, hardly a town, really. It was very small. It didn't even have a cinema there. We had to go into Blackwood for the local cinema. It did have a miners' institute. In actual fact, that institute has been moved brick by brick down to the Welsh Folklore Museum down at St Fagans in Cardiff. So it's been preserved for all time. But this particular miners' institute, they would hold sort of local dances there, or you might even have a film show sometimes in the hall. It would be used for social purposes. So that was somewhere where we could go. But we also had our own facilities in the hostel, of course, where you had a lounge and a games room, this kind of thing. No television, of course, in those days. You could listen to the radio.
Was it only miners who could go to the institute?
Basically, yes. It was a miner, except on social occasions, of course, where the wives and families could go. If it was a dance or something like that.
But you used it personally?
I used it on a few occasions. Yes. Yeah. Mind you, we didn't have very much money in those days. You couldn't really afford to keep going out. Drinking, you could get some. I don't remember getting alcohol at the hostel. I got a strange feeling they didn't serve alcohol. You could always get refreshments, of course, tea, coffee, this kind of thing. But I don't remember getting it. I think you had to go out to the local pub to get alcohol because it wasn't very popular in Wales. Of course, no pubs were open on Sundays.
But could you not go to the institute and spend nothing?
You could do, yes. Yes, you could go to the institute and spend nothing. Yes, you didn't have much to spend anyway in those days. Though, surprisingly enough, you pay out of your wage. You probably had about 30 shillings pocket money. It was surprising, actually, how far that could go. But not a lot to make your journeys home, of course. Because you didn't get railway warrants for going home. You only got one a year in the annual holiday. So if you...
To go to your home.
Yes, if you wish to go home, then if say for a weekend, if you're off duty, it was at your own expense.
So who did you associate with? With whom did you associate? Who were your friends?
We associated amongst ourselves, basically. I don't think we were very popular associating with the local young ladies somehow because of this feeling of resentment of us being there, and I think a lot of them felt, no, you're not going to associate with these Bevin boys, you know.
But did it so happen?
It didn't happen in my particular case, but it must have happened. Oh yes, yes, I'm sure it did. Yes, I do know of a case of one particular person actually, where he met a Welsh girl who actually worked in the hostel, and they got married. bound to happen, isn't it, of course. I remember the walk into Blackwood to go to the local cinema, and a lot of us used to, it's quite a long walk. You had to walk a good mile before you had to cross the railway tracks. I think it was called Pontland Frith. Cross the railway tracks and walk the equivalent distance up the other side to get into Blackwood.
Did you yourself make any Welsh friends whilst you were in Oakwood?
I didn't make any Welsh friends at all, no. No, I didn't, no. No, most of the time I was sort of, my thoughts were on getting home, really. Going home at every available opportunity. Which I did. The amusing part is that after my Royal Air Force service, I was finally demobilised in 1948. They give you a record of service from the Air Force, and it said in it that my service in the Air Force had been excellent. And this airman can be highly recommended to return to his civilian occupation in the coal mining industry. So I thought, I don't think so. No.
Did you ever have any accidents?
No, I didn't actually personally have any accidents. No, I was really very lucky in that respect. Other than, of course, contracting double pneumonia, which did, in fact, leave me with a scar on the lung, but it didn't, as you remember at the time, it didn't get me out of the service. I still had to go back and serve.
Was there any workmate fraternity between the Bevin boys and the regular miners?
I think eventually, yes, there was a rapport between Bevin boys and the regular miners. I think they sort of thought, well, they're not such a bad lot after all. It was really a question of getting used to us in time.
But, I mean, as far as you were concerned?
Yeah, I got on all right. Yes, I got on all right with them. Yes, but I think if you more or less did as you were told and pulled your weight, you were all right. But if you sort of played up a bit, then, you know, you were very, very unpopular. It was always wise to keep in with the man in charge underground. He was known as the deputy, that was his name. And he was like an under-manager, and he was responsible for allocating specific jobs. Each time Morris got, he used to say, well, you were on the conveyor belt, so that, carry on with that. But if you got on the wrong side of these deputies, they'd give you the most rotten jobs. Another thing, I should mention this about being underground, was and they were very strict in instilling this into us, that if you wanted to answer the call of nature, you did so on the spot. You did not hide away in a crevice to perform this act. The reason being that it was highly dangerous to do so, because you got pockets of methane gas in crevices, and it would be very unsafe to do so. So they said, you know, if that's it, you want to do something, you do it there on the spot. So that was the accepted practice. There were no toilets underground, of course.
Did you run foul of the deputy yourself?
No, I did not. No. No, I've rather wise not to do so. I think, you know, in the end, that after time, because again, this was a new scheme. You can imagine, can't you, an influx of young men. None of us have got our hands dirty in our lives. Suddenly coming down there and invading the place. You know, it's quite understandable that there was a certain amount of resentment. I thought, oh my goodness, you know, what have we got here?